Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, it's Valentine's Day, and if you got a gift from someone, chances are it was chocolate. We're going to talk all about it today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, here on Heritage Radio Network. And indeed, it's Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
And today, we're talking about, I said, chocolate. So who do I have sitting in the studio with me but Clay Gordon, one of our hosts here on Heritage Radio. Clay's show is called Straight from the Source, and it explores issues in fair and ethical sourcing, particularly chocolate and all things chocolate. Clay is an internationally recognized independent authority on chocolate and author of the 2008 IACP finalist book, Discover Chocolate. He's also the creator and, I guess, moderator, right,
yeah,
of the website thechocolatelife.com, and which is an online community of chocolatiers chocolate lovers.
Not just chocolate lovers and not just chocolatiers. We span the entire spectrum, from cocoa farmers in about 30 countries around the world to celebrity chefs here in the United States. Certainly there are people who would call themselves just chocolate enthusiasts, but I have chocolate makers, confectioners, people who span the entire spectrum.
Now, I have gone onto the site. I'm not
a
member, sorry to say, but I've gone to the site.
It's free, no charge.
And you have chats. I mean, you have discussion forums and things all about chocolate.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's really a place where people can come and get answers to their questions about chocolate. I started out a blog back in 2001 called chocofile.com, and it was probably the first professional ratings and reviewings website. But about the time that I started promoting Discover Chocolate, what I discovered was that the world had changed, and I really didn't want this to be about my voice. I felt pressure to write something new and interesting and come up with a point of view that would engage people, but people weren't responding.
Well, chocolate's a good topic.
Chocolate's a great topic. So I went and tried to say, how can I solve the problem? You know, after somebody said, you know, I was in Italy 20 years ago, and I ran across this chocolate, and it was wrapped in green, and I would really like to find it again. Could you help me? And I would get these once or twice or three times a week, just really obscure questions. Huh. And I could spend all my time doing nothing but answer obscure questions that nobody would pay me for. And so by creating the community, what I realized I was doing, I was aggregating or crowdsourcing all of this knowledge about chocolate and cocoa and technique and history and, you know, market, all this stuff from people all around the world. And people give freely.
Yeah, that's great.
So it's a fabulous. We just hit 7,000 members this
terrific.
Week.
Well, congratulations.
In 140 countries. Yeah, thank you.
Well, you mentioned cacao and chocolate, so I want to kind of go back for our listeners and give some form here to our discussion and some definitions. Okay. You just got back. I mean, everyone's talking about, you know, you can't buy anything anymore in America. I mean, it's without it being specific origins and specific types and gourmet this and, you know, specific wines, beef, mm-hmm, and chocolate, right, as well. Now, you just got back from a trip to Peru, so you're really, you know, keyed up and primed to talk about all these happenings. But tell us a little. We're hearing a lot about people touting new brands as single origin chocolates. So I'm going to hear your whole take and your whole opinion on this. And having gone to a grove or a plantation where it's just a single origin bean, tell me about it.
Well, it's really a question of, you know, everything old being new again.
So, and chocolate has been around for over 4,000 years from what we know. I mean, 2000 BC, right. Some of the first we know of. So it's old.
Yes. Chocolate consumed as a beverage. So consuming the seeds, actually. You can actually go back much further in history. So there is this divide between South America and Central America. And in South America, the natives there's no evidence ever, even though that's the homeland of cacao. Right, that they
and
ever
cacao. Okay, here are a definition. Cacao being the plant.
Well, yes, but the sort of accepted differentiation mm-hmm. is cacao when it's wet. Cacao tree, cacao pod, cacao seed.
Okay,
cocoa bean,
cocoa
powder.
Okay.
Right.
See, there we
so
change.
Wet
okay.
and dry. Wet and dry
right. good,
is
good.
The
that's,
difference.
That's easy.
So it's an easy way to think about it. So the upper reaches of the Amazon River near the modern-day border of Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador is considered to be the homeland of cacao. And one of the reasons why we think that's the case, we haven't pinpointed the actual magical valley where it happened, is that the closer you get to the center of genetic diversity, the more likely you are to the center of origin. Hmm. So the more genetic diversity we get. So if we look around the world, there might be two or three or four or five varieties that are planted, and they've hybridized. But you can go back and look at what they're doing. You look at their common ancestry and realize that they were introduced. But as you get into the upper regions of the Amazon River basin, which are south, by the way, the upper Amazon
the upper
is
south,
right? And in relative terms, because we're only talking about 300 meters above sea level over 3,000 miles. 3,000 kilometers, huh. Don't want to mix systems, that you find the origin of cacao. And we don't want to confuse the origin of cacao with the notion of origin chocolate or single origin chocolate. An origin chocolate is just one that says, okay, somewhere on the label it says where the beans are from. And if it doesn't say where the beans are from, it's a blend of beans from multiple locations. Mm-hmm. Usually it's a bulk bean from West Africa or Indonesia, which has been blended with flavor beans, usually from Central America, South America, or the Caribbean, although there are some other places where flavor beans are grown, in order to be able to achieve a particular flavor profile. So an origin bean says all of these beans come from a particular place, Venezuela, right? But that's not really a single origin because Venezuela is a big country. All right, so we start getting into the notion of how specific an origin are we be. So all of these things, beans come from the Carinero region, right? Or it might be a specific single varietal.
Someone's
Guasare. Or it might be from a single location mm-hmm. like Chuao. So I differentiate origin from single origin, right? Because of that difference. Another issue is that most chocolate has cocoa butter added to it. And often that cocoa butter is not made from the same beans that the chocolate is made from.
Uh-huh.
And so if I'm making a chocolate from beans that come from Venezuela, but the cocoa butter comes from Ghana, is that a single origin chocolate? And in my way of thinking, no, it's not. And so origin is, it can be very, very broad, a country, mm-hmm. or very, very specific, a particular farm.
So do you look at this new, well, it's not a new, this is not new.
Prior to the Industrial Revolution, pretty much every, it was the boat came in and you had beans from Venezuela, or the boat came in and you had beans from Trinidad, or the boat came in and you had beans from Ecuador.
So it was single origin.
So it was all single origin until we run into
artisanal chocolates and the new single origin craze. Do you think it's more of a marketing ploy than anything? Think people feel that their product makes their product seem special or unique?
Well, no, I don't think it's actually a marketing ploy at all. I think it's going back and understanding the roots and, again, origin of a product. And it's really following along in other foods. So, for example, if we look at, you know, blended jug wine, and then, we had Chablis, whatever that meant, right? Or, in 2 liters, big things, and we right. really didn't pay much attention to it.
Kind of killed the whole name Chablis right. for people forever.
Right. And then you've got this increasing sophistication of, you know, we understand the difference between a Syrah and a Merlot and a Mourvedre and, you know, all these other mm-hmm. grape varietals. And there's reason to do so because they produce very different products. And the same thing is true of chocolate. Chocolate, which is made from beans from specific areas, have, you know, generally recognizable flavor profiles. And so there's nothing fancy. There's nothing, marketing speak. I mean, it's real when people are creating the origin chocolate. as they're doing.
It's just that their idea of origin is different. Single origin is different than your idea of.
It's just semantics.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Right. I'm being a purist. And, right. You know.
Well, what I would really, I mean, I think it was the food historian Sophie Coe said that trying to put the history of chocolate onto one page is sort of like trying to put the entire ocean into a walnut shell. So we're not really going to talk too much about the rest of the history of chocolate, because suffice it to say, it's been around a long time, originated in the Mesoamericas,
there is a great book. There's a great book, The True History of Chocolate, by Sophie and Michael Coe.
If people
want to really begin to delve into the history of chocolate, that's a fabulous book.
Right. But what, being that it is Valentine's Day, what kind of got to me is like, all of a sudden, you know, we as I say, we go and we buy chocolate, and it's all this fancy artisanal chocolate. No longer do you have your 5-cent candy bar. You've got your $8.99 bar of artisanal chocolate, special chocolate. So what happened? You know, there was the Hershey came along and kind of formed America, at least America's ideas of what chocolate should taste like. Tell me a little bit about what happened what happened from the pre-industrial chocolate time to then we got into big industrial time?
Well, you know, pre-industrial chocolate means that pretty much everything is made by hand. So by definition, you have a craft, artisan, small scale product, which is generally distributed in a very narrow area around where you are. It turns out the baker of Baker Chocolate was the first chocolate factory in the Americas, in the colonies, that produced chocolate that was distributed over a wide area. So their particular expertise, again, not making great chocolate necessarily, it was used for baking, but finding a way to make a chocolate that could be distributed, right, around the colonies. Prior to that, you know, you had small cottage industries all over the country, often arranged around the local grain mill. Right? So you'd take your beans to the local grain mill, they'd grind it up for you, or you had a slave do it for you and your property. You actually can go down to Colonial Williamsburg and see examples of how chocolate was made in the colonies prior to the American Revolution. It's really quite interesting how that goes. So Milton Hershey's genius is not that he made good chocolate. Objectively, it's not good chocolate. What he did was he figured out how to make chocolate affordable to everybody, right? And he did that by replacing the expensive ingredient, cocoa, with cheap ingredients, milk and sugar. Right, and so finally you had a product, and he adopted technology which was invented in Europe, and he figured out a way to make the chocolate cheaply enough so that basically everybody who had a nickel in their pocket could afford to buy chocolate. Now, unfortunately, one of the things that happened, he wasn't able to license the patent for powdered milk from Henri Nestle, and so he went to England and saw how they were doing milk chocolate in England, and he created sweetened condensed milk. You sweeten condensed milk. If you've ever worked with chocolate, you need to take the water out of anything you add to it. Otherwise, the chocolate will seize.
Right.
And so he used sweetened condensed milk. But in the process of condensing it, the milk went slightly sour. And so the chocolate that we eat today from Hershey's Milk Chocolate, 120 some odd years later, is actually flavored based on a manufacturing mistake.
We're so used to that sour milk taste, we wouldn't want it any other way, right?
And that's the challenge with industrial products. The hallmark of an industrial product is absolute repeatability. And so one of the things that happened in the late 80s is that the chocolate world, recognizing the success that the wine world was having, said, what if we go back and start to celebrate the craft roots and the varietal origins? And start experimenting. Does the chocolate made with beans from Venezuela taste different from the chocolate that's made from beans from Africa? And if it does, you know, we have this whole new realm of chocolate that we can explore flavors, but also we can create a premium priced product. Right? Mm-hmm. So part of the just overall renaissance in chocolate in the last 20 years has been the fact that there is a premium priced product that people will pay more for, number one, of course, but also it gives them an excuse for connoisseurship. You know, it's really difficult. I mean, I know that there are people who are connoisseurs of Cadbury. Cadbury in the UK tastes different from Cadbury in South Africa. Yeah. It's made under license by Hershey here in the United States. And there are people who can pick up a bar of Cadbury and say, yeah, this was made in Canada and this one was made in South Africa. I mean, there are connoisseurs of mass market chocolate in that way. But what it did is it gave people an opportunity to take what it is that they'd learn in wine, single malt scotch, beer, and to be able to apply it to a food that they'd known since childhood, which is chocolate.
Chocolate, right?
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. And in tasting chocolate, I mean, a lot of people, as we were talking before the show, a lot of people lead chocolate tasting tours. But they're not, I mean, I don't think that they are tasting what you're talking about. I don't think they're tasting notes of necessarily where this chocolate comes from or what the flavors are. Tell me about tasting chocolate.
Well, first of all, there aren't a whole lot of people in the world who are independents, who can pick up a piece of chocolate and go, the beans in this chocolate come from this place. I mean, that requires somebody who's got years and years and years of experience and probably somebody who's involved day-to-day in manufacturing chocolate. And it's the same way in wine. I mean, how long does it take to get a master in wine? Yeah. I mean, it takes a long time. Yeah. And part of what it is you're doing is you're developing a taste memory.
I mean, it's not James Bond. You can't just sniff the wine and tell me the vintage and exactly the location and the wine.
No, you can if you spend a lot of time thinking about it.
I'm talking about you, Clay. Can you?
No, I personally cannot. One of the things that I learned is that I don't really have the kind of taste memory which is required in order to be able to do this at this level. Mm-hmm. So the way I approach tasting now when I give my classes is how to help people understand why they like what it is that they like. So it's more about the process of tasting and giving them techniques that they can use in order to be able to build their own palate.
Well, we are going to examine some of those techniques and taste a little bit of this chocolate when we come back after a short break.
This one's called Pumpkin Pie by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie?
Oh, like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Come on and save it all for me. Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam? Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam? Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day. Oh, won't you save it, baby? Please save it. Come on and save it all for me. Your pumpkin pie. Oh, won't you save all?
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, we are back on A Taste of the Past, and I've got Clay Gordon here with me. Clay is a host, as I mentioned earlier, here at Heritage Radio Network. Straight from the Source is his show, and it's all about chocolate, and we are talking all about chocolate. You know, Clay, you made an interesting point and a note here to me that during the American Revolution, there were more chocolate makers than there were colonies
There were more chocolate makers in the
colonies than there were in England.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, I read that wrong one. Yeah.
And there were probably more chocolate makers than colonies as well.
And why do you think that was?
Well, number one is that we were very, very close to the source of supply. So cocoa beans would have come from Mexico and the Caribbean and Central and South America. They probably didn't. Some of them might have been transshipped from American ports to England, right? But there was always longstanding resentment at the English for taxing tea. And so chocolate was seen as a sort of revolutionary beverage, if you will. As a matter of fact, after the Boston Tea Party, more colonists turned to consuming chocolate and coffee because they weren't taxed coming through England to the colonies.
Right. So there we get a little bit of American history in with our chocolate. And
it is the fabulous thing about chocolate is you can study history and biology and chemistry and
politics.
You name it, comparative religion. I mean, that's what it is that fascinates me. There's some aspect of almost every part of the human condition that you can connect with chocolate in a meaningful way.
Yeah. Well, now you just made a trip to Peru a couple weeks ago. Tell me what you discovered there. What you went and what you were looking for. What you found.
Well, I was in northern Peru. I'm working with a consulting client who's developing a new product, sourcing one of the ingredients for the product out of northern Peru, and visited this fabulous cooperative called Sepi Cafe, and they're about 17 years old. Focusing primarily in coffee, bulk coffee, not necessarily high-end coffee, but they also do mango and oranges. I had the most amazing mango when I was there. It was just so
the
fresh.
The idea of mango, oranges, coffee, and chocolate all melded into one
with
is passion really...
fruits, passion fruit as well. It's insane.
That's sounding real good to me right now.
It was also the middle of summer there as opposed to the middle of winter, and so it was great. But, you know, Sepi Cafe just started working in cocoa about 6 years ago, and they've gone from no production to about 60 metric tons of cocoa, which is a lot in a very short period of time. And they are very, very sophisticated. They have a genetics program to identify the varieties that are planted in their region. They're doing work on propagating specific varieties, and they plan to go to double production in the next 2 years from 60 to 120 tons and then to 1,000 tons, which is a lot of cocoa. In the next 5 to 6 years, and all of it is going to be this highly prized 100% white bean cocoa. So one of the, I think, misconceptions that people have about chocolate is people think that the better the chocolate is, the more intense, the more chocolatey flavored it is. And it turns out that the most highly prized beans make chocolate that's more delicate and more nuanced in flavor.
Like wine.
Yeah. And
all right, I'm going to back up because you mentioned, and this is something that I think people, if they haven't done a study of chocolate, have never seen a cacao pod.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful. I mean, the trees are phenomenal, and the pods are gorgeous. All right, so you open up and you get the beans, but it's a very lengthy process before they're cleaned out and you get them and ferment them and everything. But they are indeed white.
In this particular case, you open up the bean and it's pure white. Absolutely.
So take us quickly through a little bit of a process how they get to where we actually consume them.
Oh, gosh. How do you make chocolate in 2 minutes or less?
Not the whole way.
Right. So the cacao pod grows on the tree, and the tree does not fall. The pod doesn't fall on the ground, so it has to be harvested. So you'll pull the pod off the tree. You open up the pod, and inside, attached to a central placenta, are the seeds. The size of the seeds, how many there are, all these other characteristics depends on the variety.
The center of a melon, sort of like a pulp.
Yeah, but imagine seeds the size of almonds, not watermelon seeds. The seeds are covered in this very sweet fruit, for want of a better word. It's called cocoa pulp, which is fabulous. Sucking the pulp off of seeds off a fresh pod is an experience that every chocolate lover should travel to origin somewhere and enjoy in their life. The seeds are fermented in that pulp, right? So the seeds don't ferment. They're fermented in, it's the pulp that ferments. And what happens is that there's, again, another myth that people think that in order to develop chocolate flavor, you must ferment the beans. And you can wash all the pulp off the beans, not ferment them and dry them. And then when you roast them, you will develop a chocolate flavor. It's just there's no nuance. It's a single straightforward chocolate note. So fermentation is responsible for developing all of the chemicals, right? All of the precursors to flavors and aroma that generate all these other flavors besides chocolate during the roasting process. right? So how long fermentation takes depends upon the variety of the beans. Now, the white beans are white because they don't contain high quantities of anthocyanins, the purple components that people think of as being antioxidants. It's what,
right?
White blueberries are as good as they are, and the white beans contain none of them. So it doesn't take very long to ferment them because there aren't a whole lot of chemicals that need to be converted. Right, so beans which are very dark purple can take 5, 6, 7 days to ferment, and the white beans 24 hours, 36 hours to ferment, depending on how it gets done. And then once they're fermented, they're laid out generally in the sun to dry. And at that point, they generally leave the country of origin. They leave where they're grown, and they get shipped halfway across the world to be converted into chocolate.
And they're usually roasted on site?
No, they're roasted at the factory where the chocolate is made. And I actually think it's that separation, which is one of the reasons why there's this 100-year gap in chocolate appreciation. So imagine if all the grapes used to make champagne were grown in West Africa. Imagine if all the grapes, you know, all the olives used to make Italian olive oil were grown in Peru. I mean, there's this divide between origin and manufacture. And a lot of it, you know, a lot of the interest in the foods come from the fact that it's, you know, the terroir issue is not just soil and weather and things like that. It's also the local practices that get used to make it. It's champagne, not because of a particular grape grown in a particular area, but a particular manufacturing process. And because cocoa beans are grown thousands of miles away in the tropics, places that have generally been exploited and ignored, that it lost its connection to artisan roots. And we're just rediscovering that. And that's what's really exciting about it, is closing the gap between the producer and the consumer and really getting a better understanding of what it takes to produce a superior chocolate, which requires a superior bean to begin with.
Okay, so talking about superior chocolates, we were going to talk about tasting them, and you've brought a couple different varieties with you.
Right.
Lead me through the tasting process and what we should be looking, what we should be tasting or looking for.
Well, the most important thing about tasting is that it's a conscious process, and that I differentiate it from eating. The whole idea of tasting is you stop, slow down, pay attention. What does it smell like? What does it look like? What is it? What flavors do you have? What aromas do you have? What textures do you have in the mouth? And it's really all about being able to catalog them and then write them down, or because you're not going to remember them. And then being able to say, oh, I remember that flavor because I encountered that flavor someplace before. If I were to just hand you something, you'd go, I taste something. I don't necessarily know what it is, but I know that it's unusual for chocolate. And then you might go, oh, I say it's lemongrass, and you go, oh, yeah, right, it's lemongrass, I understand. It's lemongrass. And so if you have a good taste memory, and that's really what tasting is all about, is developing a memory so you can go, ah, I've tasted that before, I know what it is, that you would go, oh, that's what lemongrass tastes like in chocolate.
Right? Being able to separate, in any recipe, in any food,
right.
It's being able to analyze those flavors that you're that
deconstructing,
are coming through,
right? deconstructing the flavors,
right.
And that's what it is that I try to do. Rather than say, oh, here's some wine, here's some chocolate, they go together, or to be able to say to somebody, here's a piece of chocolate, tell me what you taste. You know, having confidence in your sense of taste, being able to articulate your sense of taste, that's what is the differentiation between a great chef and a good chef.
And super taste, people have, not super tasters in terms of bitterness, but people who have a palate that, you know, can discern those and deconstruct those flavors. Right. And you said taste memory.
And a lot of it is taste memory.
Yeah.
You can do it brute force. You know, that's the reason, I think, to do tasting in groups. So 4 or 5 people all sitting around tasting the same thing will have different impressions of it. And you might not get something, but somebody will go, ah, and you'll go, yeah, that's what that is. Of course, that's what it is.
Right.
And so I have 2 chocolates today, one of which is from a company in Amsterdam. I was there in October. It's just called Chocolate Makers, and this is called their Gorilla Bar. It's made with cocoa from East Congo, from an area called Virunga, and part of the proceeds go to help you know, gorilla conservation in that area. And you tried it, and you...
Before the show, I tasted it, and a secondary flavor was coming through, and I wanted to say, my taste memory, I guess, wasn't so good today. Mm-hmm. I was picking up something. I didn't know whether it was a berry or... there was a secondary flavor coming through, and I can't place it. What do you get?
There are lots of things going on here. So
our mouths are full of chocolate.
There's a fruit acid. There's some warm spice notes. There's something that's reminiscent of a berry. What kind of berry is it?
A little bitter, a little sour.
There's a little bitter. Yeah. But what happens is that the flavor changes over time. So there's a flavor that starts in the mouth. That's associated also with the initial smell through the nose as opposed to retronasal aromas. And as the chocolate warms up, more aromas are released. There are some aromas that are in the fat. When water comes in and starts warming up, you get other kinds of aromas which are released. And that's one of the hallmarks of most origin chocolates, varietal chocolates, is that you do get this roller coaster of flavor in the mouth. You get to this major, major change. I mean, I have another chocolate here, which is, you know, I was doing an event last night. I just needed a simple chocolate which I could melt up and do things with, which would go for a variety of things. So, you know, my go-to chocolate when I'm doing that kind of things is just, you know, Trader Joe's, you know, Pound Plus bars, because they're easy to find and they're relatively expensive, relatively inexpensive. But if you were to put this chocolate in your mouth, it's a higher percentage, 72 as opposed to 68. What you've got is a chocolate which has got, you know, an okay chocolate flavor, but it has, it's single note. There's a piece here for you if you want to try it.
Just a chocolate hit.
It's just a chocolate hit. And, you know, there's a place for this chocolate in the world. It's great to cook with. It works really well when you're making a fondue or something like that, especially if you mix a little milk chocolate into it. It's a fabulous kind of thing. But, you know, there's none of this complexity that's associated with it. And that's where the varietal chocolates start being really interesting, the origin chocolates start being really interesting. I mean, there's an American chocolate maker by the name of Art Pollard out of Orem, Utah. And he has a chocolate made with beans from Papua New Guinea that have this bright pink grapefruit aroma flavor associated with them. And you go pink grapefruit, naturally occurring. There's no addition of anything in the way of flavor to the chocolate. It's just he gets pink grapefruit out of it. Huh. It's just astonishing. I mean, it's not a chocolate I would eat every day, but just was wild being able to get that flavor out of it.
Well, so in your opinion, is then the taste of the chocolate, is there a good chocolate, bad chocolate? Tell me what makes a good chocolate, bad chocolate, a matter of taste or a matter of production?
Oh, well, there are some, I mean, as
and
somebody,
if I were to go and buy it, what would I look for?
you know, I spent the last, you know, 20 years, you know, looking for answers to this question. You have to look at it subjectively and objectively. Subjectively, if you like the chocolate, it's good chocolate. You know, there's hands down. I'm not going to try to argue with you that your
taste
is bad.
Sometimes a Hershey's Kiss just does the trick.
You know, and I had this wonderful series of vignettes I was writing a couple of years ago where I would talk to chefs about their secret chocolate obsessions. And it's surprising the number of top chefs who go, yeah, when I'm not eating chocolate in my kitchen, I'm, you know, Snickers or Maltesers or, you know, it's really quite surprising. You know, I had a jonesing the other day for, I just needed peanut M&Ms, you know. And so, you know, even though I've got all this fabulous chocolate, there was something that only a peanut M&M would satisfy. And recognizing it and going, yeah, it's okay to do that is just fine. Although, objectively, they're not very good. You know, I've got this...
They're not a sponsor, are they?
But when it comes to subjectively, it's one of those things. The more you know about chocolate, the more you can appreciate the nuances. And so when we talk about sort of, you know, objective measures, I can look at things and I can say this chocolate is well made. So, for example, if you open something up and the first aroma you get is sugar, chances are it's not well made. Mm. If the first aroma you get is vanilla, especially if it tastes like artificial or aromas artificial vanilla, you know that the chocolate is not well made. Vanilla in the chocolate industry is called a masking aroma. It's designed to hide imperfections, right? If your first impression you get when you put something in your mouth is that the chocolate tastes like the beans are burned, well, yeah, they've been burned. Bitterness is often a function of roasting. Mm. And you do that to cover up the fact that you're using low quality beans. If I burn it hard enough, it's like coffee, right? If I burn it hard enough, if I'm using bad beans, nobody can tell because the only thing I'm getting is the burn flavor, right? So, you know, we can look at, you know, objective defects. I can look at things like texture. Does it melt well? Is it sandy? These are things that, you know, are very easy to say, this is not well-made chocolate. When it comes to flavor, you know, it's okay, this is a bean from Ecuador. The traditional flavor of chocolate made from beans from Ecuador should have some fruity, floral, orange blossom, jasmine. So if somebody gives me a bar of chocolate made from the Cacao Nacional from Ecuador, and it doesn't have these flavors in it, I can say, well, it doesn't represent very well its origin, right? Because it doesn't have this characteristic flavor. But it could be a very interesting, well-made chocolate that's got some fun flavors in it and might be fun to eat. Right? Hmm. But we're just now getting to the point where there are enough people who have spent enough time thinking about it that we can sort of generally catalog what the base flavor profile of particular beans from specific parts of the world should be, so that we can say, yeah, we can at least start doing this baseline analysis. One of the challenges is that there's not enough money, right? I mean, there are $1,000 bottles of wine and $10,000 bottles of wine, which means there's enough money in the ecosystem to pay for sommeliers and masters of wine to be able to educate you on why it's okay to spend $10,000 on a bottle of wine. You know, if all the wine was, you know, $9, you know, a jug bottle Chablis, then you would need sommeliers. There's not, you know, there's number one, no need. Right, but there's no money to support them. We're at that same place in chocolate. I mean, there's this real interest in and demand for more expertise, so that we can educate people about appreciating chocolate.
Well, and I think that chocolate is such a desirable product that there's a lot of self-education going on. People want to buy. They look at on the shelves in a gourmet market, and I'm waiting for a specialty shop, but they're looking on the shelves or they're going into a special chocolatier's place of business, and they want to try something new. They want to try, and then all of a sudden the percentages,
it's overwhelming.
And they don't really necessarily understand it, but they want to learn. Mm-hmm. I think they really want to because it's such a good product.
Oh, it's fabulous. And one of the great things about chocolate, like cheese, for example, is that I can go out and with $20 in my pocket, buy the best chocolate in the world, right? And there aren't a whole lot of other gourmet foods that you can do that with.
Well, now what I'm waiting for is a specialty. We have now a couple of salt shops where you can buy different salts from all over the world and different types and taste them. I'm waiting for that chocolate shop. We're not talking about confections.
Right. Just we're talking about
chocolate. Just
well,
bar
we have two in New York
chocolate.
City. We have two decent artisan craft chocolate stores in New York City. One of them is the Salt Store, which is the Meadow in the West Village. Mark Bitterman has done a good job of collecting bars from all over the world, curating, if you want, a selection of bars. And there's a new store on Park Avenue South, which is called Two Beans. It's between 40th and 41st Street. And they have actually a broader selection than the Meadow. And not only is it broader, but within certain manufacturers, they have a much broader selection within manufacturers.
Well, Mark has been on my show early on, and he's got a shop out in Portland as well.
The original shop is in Portland.
I'm sure out in the West Coast there must be some chocolate shops that are specializing. So,
oh no,
it's something we can look forward to.
I mean, you know, but there's a good one. There are a couple of good ones in San Francisco. Believe it or not, one of the biggest selections of chocolate bars in the country is in Salt Lake City.
Huh, interesting.
Well, you can't drink coffee, you can't drink alcohol.
Might as well have chocolate.
but they are very much labors of love. I mean, it really requires somebody not only who loves chocolate, but who understands it and understands how to market it and merchandise it. It's surprising, and then
help educate somebody who comes in wanting to try a good chocolate that might be a little bit different. Well, I thank you. I know we could. It's a great topic. I could go on eating it and talking about it
and
all day long, right? But in the interest of time, we have to wrap it up. And I hope you'll join me again, and we'll talk further about chocolate. And to those of you listening, I hope you got a nice chocolate gift for Valentine's Day. Thanks to Clay Gordon from Straight from the Chase, and check out his website, The Chocolate Life. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Pelaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.